Welcome to Flip Table Theology, a weekly conversation centered around flipping tables of oppression, injustice, privilege, division, and religion as acts of faith and worship.
We are so excited you guys are joining us at this table. Grab a cup of coffee or a cup of tea and let's dive in.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Flip Table Theology. I'm really crazy nerdy excited about this episode. I feel like we've had a lot of really heavy episodes recently, dealing with just a lot of really hard, complex, deep theological topics. And so we thought that we would kind of pull back just a little bit and have a conversation that is still critically important and heavily theological, but also one that centers around a passion that I know all of us around the table definitely have, and that is a passion for books and reading and literacy and studying and all of the things. And so we're going to dive into a conversation today about deconstructing our bookshelves. And I'm super stoked to jump into this with everybody. We've got everybody around the table today, some a little bit healthier than others. Poor Rue is now dealing with their round of COVID. But we've got Holly and Rue, Sharita, Phil, and myself. So let's jump in and get started. And I'm going to throw it to Sharita first, our resident literacy expert. So jump in here and talk a little bit about your feelings about this topic today.
Well, this was something that we've talked about doing for a while and something that I'm very interested in. I'm a reader. However, I have not read as much as I have in the past for a number of reasons. But when it came to my life in deconstructing, I found that I had a hard time with several different kinds of texts. One, I really struggled with the Bible. So I spent probably a couple of years really struggling to read the Bible. I also really struggled with traditional devotional books, which I've always been a fan of. I've been one of those persons who spends mornings, evenings, you know, sometime during the day reading some kind of devotion, very uplifting, but I found them problematic over the last several years and have had a hard time reading those. And then there are some of these authors who used to be my favorites, like Joyce Meyer. In the past, I had really connected with some of her books and authors like her. And those also became very problematic. So I really struggled. I was telling the group earlier before we started recording that many of the books that I've read over the last several years have been gifts of Miss Christy Love, who has an enormous book collection, but has been very helpful in finding things that I could connect with. However, I will say that one of my earliest books that started my journey of deconstruction was the work of Rachel Held Evans. And it was also a book by Jen Hatmaker. Both of those authors really helped me to connect with other people of faith who were struggling with faith. Those were two of the earliest readers. However, I think during that same period of time, I was working through some decolonizing my own Christianity and my faith background, and didn't really know where to go with some of that. And so I started reconnecting with just works of people of color that spoke to my identity and my heart and my history. So I read some just both essays and fiction works of people like J. California Cooper, bell hooks, Audre Lorde, Alice Walker, people who told stories that I didn't have to shift my mindset and my identity in order to be able to connect with it. So guess I'll just start the conversation with that.
Well, and I think you bring up something that's so critical, Sharita, because, you know, one of the aspects of deconstructing our book collections and what we're reading and what we're exposing ourselves to, there's also an aspect that has to be done of also decolonizing our bookshelves. For me, I had a recognition about a decade ago when I was moving and packing up books that the vast majority of the books on my bookshelf were written by white theologians and white authors. And that was a really convicting piece to me. I had friends at the time, a good friend who was going through seminary. And one of the things that she was really pushing back on in her seminary was, why are we only reading white theologians? And why are we only reading scriptural interpretations from predominantly white men? And so that was a big challenge. And so I really became very intentional trying to seek out voices of color, indigenous voices, indigenous spirituality, like various ways to add voices and perspectives that maybe weren't even my own. So, you know, where you talk about kind of going back to your roots, I think it's equally as important for us to recognize that if that isn't our lived experience, it's still critical that we expose ourselves to those lived experiences and those thoughts and perspectives and histories. And the best way to do that a lot of times as a starting point is reading and having the chance to engage in stories.
One of the books that was a part of that connection between my cultural, racial, spiritual, religious experience was I'm Still Here, Black Yes. Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness by Austin Channing Brown. That was a book that really helped me to connect all of my experiences together. Oftentimes there is this in the books that I've read or have been exposed to, talks about some of the challenges with evangelical spaces, which is where I have had been. And also then there are ones that talk kind of about the Black experience in spirituality. This was one that kind of brought them back together for me and allowed me to really construct some thoughts and feelings and ideas connecting those two together.
You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot at the Connecting Grounds and just in general as a principle is that, like, part of deconstruction has to be a widening of our circle and like an introduction of new voices. And I think that there are people who I have talked to who, you know, try to make different kinds of justifications and excuses of, you know, well, I don't live in a really diverse area, or there aren't a lot of different kinds of people around me that I can try to invest and get to know and build relationships with. And again, books are a great way to bridge that as a starting point. It's not a substitution for in-person relationships and building those relationships, but it's a critical starting point for people who maybe have some of those challenges in terms of widening their circle.
And I also just think that my book collection in my past in particular has really demonstrated to me how compartmentalized mm-hmm. I have been living with regards to my faith and my culture. My faith and my race have been completely separate on my bookshelf. They weren't at all connected. And over the last couple of years, I've really taken a concerted effort to merge those worlds, and so they don't have to be so compartmentalized and separate.
Yeah, that's good. Phil, Holly, Rue, how about you guys?
I think for me, one of the things that I value a lot about deconstructing your bookshelf, because I think books in like evangelical circles, whenever it was like an evangelical written book, it was like next in my head, it was like next to, you know, the truth of the gospel, like that kind of like level of bridge, as long as it's the same theology, you know, Christian writer, this is where we're at. And I think venturing out and exploring different books was a big part of my deconstruction. And also like a permission that I didn't give myself till a lot later on in my deconstruction. It was like, oh, I want to hold on to this, you know, this book, or like, you know, I may have learned something from there. Like, it was this like letting go of some things. But for me, one of the books that I think was like, I think a tipping point was God and the Gay Christian. because I think that was, you know, coming to terms with my queerness and then not having any really like Christian queer books. I think there was a lot of like LGBTQ history out there, like a lot of really cool books that I still really value. But that was the first one that I found that like also talked about the theology and the inaccurate theology around queer people or within in the Bible and scriptures. And that was this huge moment of like, oh, like my queerness and my faith don't have to be separate. It can be together. And that was huge. And I really value that book. And there was other books that also impacted that, like Homosexuality in the Bible and stuff like that. But I think the way Matt wrote that book was also very like his own personal experience. And it was really beautiful. So I think that was like the branching point to also like other queer theologians. And yeah, really, really
can we just
pivotal.
Point out the theme here of having as living as a Christian, how we've had this experience of having to separate ourselves from ourselves in order to have this Christian experience. Like that's a shared theme between both what Rue and I have said so far.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we talk about that as a form of religious trauma, you know, the inability to authentically be yourself. And I think when you're having to find connection points for your authentic self in the pages of a book, because you don't have those necessarily around you, you know, you cannot underestimate the literal life-saving power of someone writing down their journey and writing down their story and how that can connect as a lifeline to somebody who maybe is closeted or who is in a area where, you know, they are definitely not the majority culture. What that looks like to be able to connect to your core, your heart, your soul through pages when you can't connect through people is incredibly important.
Yeah, I think one of the things too, as someone who is deconstructing in teen years too, how books were this like, and just reading in general was this like, okay, my parents weren't big readers, but I like to read. So it was like this like thing that was just mine. And I don't know if that's a thing that a lot of people can like relate to, but this like, okay, I can hear my story and like, or choose whatever story I want to listen to just within these books. And that was also this like, I don't know, they have a passage way to opening up bigger things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things I also just want to like introduce into this conversation is when we talk about deconstructing your bookshelf, we're not only talking about academic titles. We're not only talking about nonfiction works or theological works. I want to like emphasize, don't underestimate the power of fiction and the importance of fiction books, even in your deconstruction journey. I oftentimes will suggest for people, maybe who are starting to volunteer for the first time or starting their deconstruction journey, different fiction novels that actually expose them to people and situations and social scenarios that maybe they haven't really engaged with a whole lot. And that starts to stir up questions, starts to open their eyes, starts to kind of lead to conversations that do help to bridge engagement in the real world and what that looks like. So, you know, Rue, when you talk about, you know, those stories and how those were yours, I think it's important we talk about you can't ever underestimate the power of a story, and that
Absolutely.
Doesn't always have to be, you know, a more nonfiction centered book. That can be a beautiful fiction as well.
Absolutely.
I like what you said about fiction books, because I also think that sometimes books that are not necessarily, I mean, books that aren't fiction or that are nonfiction or are more academic or whatever, I think that the books that fall in those other categories can open us up to like compassion and empathy in a whole different way, because it often allows us to relate to someone that doesn't necessarily feel super real, but it like opens us up into a space of like I'm connecting with this person and I'm falling in love with this person. And I see that in a lot of like for me, I fell in love with a fiction book this year that just and it's not necessarily deconstruction, but compassion for the world. And it's The Remarkably Bright Creatures by
I just
Shelby.
finished it.
Yes, I brought it to Christine. I was like, you have to read this book. It's by Shelby Van Pelt. And it's this beautiful story of like three different people and their lives that intertwine. But like,
And an
and
octopus.
I was getting there.
Oh, sorry.
But like my favorite part of the book is like it teaches a lot of compassion between these different people and their stories, all wildly different. And like there's themes of grief, there's themes of trauma and loneliness throughout, but there's this really beautiful theme of this octopus that has been trapped and living in this aquarium, who actually narrates part of the story. So it's really fun. But this compassion that this and this friendship that this woman forms with this octopus. And I love it and I've recommended it to so many people because it's such a beautiful way to be like, see the wild world differently, like open your eyes to this whole different space of compassion in a book that feels really freeing because it is fun and it's energizing and it has a lot of life in it. So I really love books like that. I know for me growing up, I was different than you, Rue, in that I grew up in a house that read more than anything else. And so my parents have these like enormous bookshelves and they're getting ready to move cross country. And my when they came to visit me this fall, my dad brought me boxes of books because they've been cleaning out. And it was honestly the most beautiful, like emotional thing for me to go through some of these books. But for me, I grew up with an enormous amount of poetry and an enormous amount of classical literature and a lot of like multicultural books. And so a lot of it was more historical, but like books on Irish folklore and like Celtic stories and things like that that were a little bit more like mystical and things like that. And I think for me, I grew up kind of in this world of I was in this religious bubble in real life, but I was given this like window to imagination and to connection to things that were much more spiritual. But yet I was there was this huge disconnect for so long in like this anti fear of this spiritual world. And I think for me, a lot of like I went through a series of my a period of time in my life where I was very, very nomadic. In fact, it like triggered a background check once because I'd lived in so many addresses for like a period of a couple years. But one of the things that I carried with me was like this tote of books, and it was all my poetry books, and it was these kind of mystical spiritual things that just like really grounded me because they were not super grounded. Like they were just beautiful. And I think for me, in this season of my deconstruction, finding books that connected spirituality to my core beliefs have been the most healing thing for my deconstruction. And so for me, I have like fallen in love with anything that's more wild. And so that's not going to surprise anybody in the natural world. But one of my favorite books that has honestly like opened my eyes to God in the natural world, God in all of these other cultures that we have so much kinship with, has been like Robin Wall Kimmerer's
Braiding
Braiding
Sweet.
Sweetgrass. And she has another book on moss right now that I'm reading that I love too. But like Braiding Sweetgrass has been this like beautiful story of all these different indigenous beliefs and stories that have been passed down for generations, and her biology perspective on plants and the wild world and the connection to all of that spiritually. And that has been really beautiful for me. The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Wohlleben. That also like these things that are just like it's like they may not necessarily talk about Christianity and religion. While there's a lot of that that's kind of seeped into the toxicity of those cultures, those books have just been this like friend to me of like finding words for the space in my own deconstruction and my own place of like I'm embracing that I'm an incredibly spiritual human. I am not religious and I don't like that word anymore, but I can still be spiritual and not be like anti-Christian, anti, you know, that stuff.
And I think one of the other things that I love that I thought of when I was listening to you talk, Holly, is as you deconstruct and as you connect with people in your deconstruction journey, I think inherently you start to like branch out a little bit in terms of what you read, what you're willing to expose yourself to. So for me, in our friendship, Holly, over the last 10 years, like I really never was a big poetry person, but I know your passion for poetry and like you've recommended different things over the years. And so I now have like a small collection of poetry books added to like my section of liturgy books. And, you know, you've really challenged me in reading more books that have to do with nature and spirituality and some of those things.
Even though I steal them from your books.
Because you do steal them. She's like, you have to read this book, and I order it. And then she's like, oh, you got it. Now I'm going to take it and read it. And I'm like, so we have a book battle that happens. But anyway, but I appreciate that because again, I think Sherita, you kind of talked about compartmentalizing, but I think we could also talk about like a lot of us get in a rut with what we read, what we're interested in reading. And so like having people in your world and giving those people permission and saying, hey, you know, what's a book that's really impacted your life, your journey, your deconstruction journey lately? And then being willing to read those, even if it's outside of your normal wheelhouse, mm-hmm. Because I think those different perspectives are really critical and really important.
Mm-hmm. One of the most like amazing Christmases I've had recently with friends was instead of getting like traditional gifts, we got each other books that we personally found really beautiful and impactful. And I think that like that practice of sharing stories that is not only like opens up your world, but also like connects you with that person that really valued that story and gets you to know them better. And I think that's, I wish I could integrate that so much more mm-hmm. in my like daily practice because it is so, it was really beautiful and really connecting.
I love that, Rue. I've actually like processed, I'm like that would be a really beautiful way to move into like gift giving is, and I know like I do a lot of browsing through like thrift stores and there's been a lot of times I found books that I love at thrift stores and I already own a copy, but it's like, I'll pick this up because I want to gift this to somebody. And even that practice is really beautiful to be like, here's a used book that's already been well loved by somebody else that has been my favorite book that I'm gifting to you. But I think even in the like not spending money aspect of that, I really love just asking people like, what is one of the your favorite books? Like, what is a book that has been, you know, like a Bible to you almost. And I know in that season of my nomadic life, like there were two poetry collections that I like, if I went into anywhere, like I didn't leave them in my car. I always, cause they're drawn on and they're loved on. And they were both, one of them is a large collected works of Mary Oliver, who's one of my favorite earth poets and, just some of the most beautiful spiritual poetry. And then Maya Angelou, her, like a collective work of her, just like, and so much culture and rich social justice issues in her works. And so those were things that I remember walking into people's houses and people being like, what are those books? And it's like, well, let me tell you, let me read a, you know, a poem to you because it was like, this is who I am. This is who I've become because of how much these books have shaped me and changed me.
Sometimes I wonder how different I would be had I not had a friend or two along the way recommend certain books that mm-hmm. were like just absolutely life-changing. And I love the way you all are talking about all different kinds of books, as well as, you know, storytelling. You know, I think we can bring art into this, you know, lived experiences. One of the things that I think has really been a danger to a lot of largely, you know, white Christian academic theology, as Christy, you were talking about earlier, you know, a lot of times if a person goes, especially to an evangelical seminary, you know, you're mostly, you know, reading from, you know, white dudes interpreting, you know, scripture and straight cisgender white dudes interpreting, you know, scripture, theological tradition, stuff like that. And like the white European kind of white centric way of approaching theology so often is kind of like, okay, we're going to think about these ideas. And then from these ideas that we are thinking about in our mind, we're going to develop further beliefs and we're going to have our systematic theologies, volumes 1 and 2 and 3. And that's just very different from the ways that a lot of folk who are, you know, maybe on the ground or people of color, you think about liberation theologians. It's not, you know, that you're just, you know, sitting there thinking about ideas and what to believe. Instead, it's lived experiences on the ground, you know, praxis, actions, experiences that then informs belief and not the other way around. And I just think that's critical for lived experiences and the truths that are given expression through those to be what speaks, as opposed to folk just, you know, thinking big, deep thoughts or whatever that may or may not have much to do with actually lived, real, material existence.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's important to weave in our favorite phrase in the whole wide world into this conversation too, because when you start talking about freaking capitalism and the impact that it has on our bookshelves and the way that it influences what we read and who we read, you know, you start talking about, Sherita, you were talking earlier about like having certain authors, right, that were kind of your go-to authors because they were known and they were well marketed and they had, you know, a big juggernaut of a publishing house behind them churning out this content that made them seem like this really trusted source. So anytime they put out a new book, right, it was easy to go, oh, I need that new book from that author that I know so well. And I just challenge that for listeners, because I too was a huge person that kind of fell into that trap. And I am a complete book nerd. And I do have a large book collection. And one of the things that I started doing a while ago is I kind of have this system where, like, if I haven't touched a book in a long time, it starts to work itself down onto the bottom of my bookshelf. And so like that bottom row is kind of like on the bubble. And if it's a book that I'm not sure I agree with anymore, or theologically, maybe I've outgrown it, or that voice isn't safe anymore, it tends to kind of go in that section and then I clean those out. Well, my last move, when we moved to this house, I could not handle it anymore. And partly my husband couldn't handle it anymore because he has to lug my books everywhere. But I decided it was time to clean books out. And like, books are treasured possessions to me. So like, it was painful and kind of an act of grieving in a way, because instead of just taking them to a used bookstore and trying to resell them, I thought, if these are toxic to me and they have not been helpful to me, I don't necessarily want to put them out in the world for anyone else. And so I literally threw away so many books. I know that will appall some people to hear that. But it was kind of like this act of resistance for me and protest of like, these are titles that maybe played a role in keeping me pigeonholed or keeping my blinders on or keeping me inside the box in terms of a power and control kind of way. And freeing myself of those titles gave me a lot of room on physical bookshelves to challenge myself to fill in ways with, you know, even smaller publishing houses or unknown authors who maybe freaking capitalism has kind of steamrolled them in a way where their voices are getting minimized and not heard. So it's kind of been this beautiful challenge to seek out memoirs and stories that aren't necessarily always the headline makers. Mm-hmm. Who still have an amazing amount of value to bring to your bookshelves and to teaching yourself things. And so I just challenge you in that too. You know, don't always fall into the trap of the huge publishing house that puts out the next great big thing, because sometimes that great big thing is really designed to try to keep everyone where religion wants everyone versus challenging us to ask questions and to dig deeper on our own.
Yeah, I just want to say a huge amen to that. You know, the way that the Christian publishing industry is set up, it really is just sheer volume of books sold, you know, for the sake of capitalism. That's not to say there aren't some great books out there by Christian imprints. So, you know, Sherita mentioned Rachel Held Evans earlier, and, you know, she is just a treasure. And I'm so glad that her books, you know, have reached, you know, so many people. But I also know that there are a lot of incredible books that have been written that don't find, you know, one of those major imprints. And in large part because sometimes they are pushing up against a lot of those capitalistic tendencies, calling them out. And sometimes you find that I don't know how to say it other than to say that sometimes getting people to believe certain things is like shooting fish in a barrel. You know, you can there's a formula that you can put out there to sell a lot of books, but a lot of times it avoids the nuances and the complexities that people face. And so I just, yeah, it's a long way of saying yes, Christy, to what you said, like big time. And then I also have a practice every year. Brentwood has a garage sale. And so a lot of books are collected and sold. I always go through them all. And if there's like ever any of that awful toxic theology, I just pull all of that. And I don't even, this is awful. I don't even recycle it. I don't want the chance of anyone ever reading, you know, these words again.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it speaks to the duality, kind of the double-edged sword power of books, right? Like, they can help to open minds and change minds and to challenge perspectives, but they can also be used to kind of copy and paste toxic and problematic theologies and ways of thought and behavior practices that have been conducted for far too long.
I just want to jump in here and say something that, like, I'm thinking of as I'm thinking of all the, like, evangelical books that have been recommended to me as I've, like, gone through my deconstruction, and something that I've been really intentional about doing with people, because I never want to, like, this is just my personality, like, I want to give them the opportunity to, like, hear what they have to say, as long as they're willing to engage what I have to say, which is rarely the case. So a book that has been recommended to me that I think is very toxic for a lot of queer people is Gay Girl, Good God. Very, very toxic. But it's been recommended to me when I came out. And I always said, I'll read this as long as you read this book, which was always, you know, God and the Gay Christian. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, that was, no, I'm not going to read that. That's propaganda, like all these things. And then I said, well, I'm not going to read your book. So that's something that I think has been really empowering for me, is to say, like, it's not that I'm going to shut down these ideas and try to engage with things critically, but if you're not willing to do the same on my end, I'm not going to engage with you here, because that ultimately feels more like I'm just going to evangelize and push you into this, and it really does feel like a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I think that books have been weaponized in that way, in a lot of evangelical circles.
Well, and I think it's really important too to remember that, again, capitalism, right? And churches and ministries have to live with an economic reality, right? That there are funds that are needed for those doors to stay open and people to stay operational. So I do think that we've seen, as the deconstruction movement has really gained momentum, and, you know, we're watching as attendance trends continue to trend downward for people engaging in church spaces, there's been a huge surge of books that appear on the surface to be relatively progressive and to be helpful in some of these popular deconstruction kind of tension points. And queer theology is definitely one of them. We see it a lot in gender theology. We see it a lot in conversations around race and ethnicity. But when you really get into the book, you realize it's kind of just a wolf in sheep's clothing, you know, where we've just kind of clothed the same argument that's been problematic in new language or with a newer, trendier author, or, you know, with a dude with ripped jeans and a man bun, because somehow that's more appealing and seems more edgy. But we've got to be really mindful of that. So I think paying attention to, like, who the publishers are, what have they published previously, what are their stances on certain issues, kind of helps you to know if that's a safe title to be adding, and if it's going to be something that challenges perspective and helps you explore things, or if it's something that's just reinforcing the narrative that maybe you've already deemed as toxic.
I think that there's a really important piece to talk about when you talk about books, is that writing, like, storytelling is like an ancient tradition, and storytelling is the reason that we can connect to our ancestors, to other cultures and practices and things like that from thousands of years ago. In fact, that's why people love the Bible, is ancient storytelling. It's made up of storytellers who put to words experiences they had in those days. And I think that there's something really beautiful about the art of storytelling that I think sometimes we don't realize in the Western world, because we have so much access to everything, when, like, when you go back to the roots of storytelling, there was a long period of time where history was passed down verbally by storytellers. People told the stories of each other. They told these stories. They put ideas and concepts and beliefs into stories that were relatable and memorable so they could be continued to be passed down. And so I think there's something really, really poetic and beautiful and magical about the art of storytelling. What I really struggle with is how capitalistic a lot of books are, because in a lot of ways, in order to be this top seller, you have to have money to be able to put behind it. You have to have an audience. And there's almost this like culture of just like, I've made it to this point of like following. So what do I do next? Well, I'll just go ahead and write a book, instead of it being like, I have a story to share. I have myself to share. And for me, I know when I pick up a book, I've really tried to pay attention to like self-published authors, because I have a lot of friends. I'm in a poetry circle. A lot of my sisters in that circle that are people that are like, I don't want my voice changed by an editor. I know our really good friend who's been on the podcast before, Allie Henney, she wrote a book, and she was, I remember her talking very specifically about how protective she was of, I have to find a publisher and editors that aren't going to change my voice because it's not grammatical, or it's not, you know, it doesn't say the things that you want the people to hear, because this is my voice. And I remember reading her book and just being like, I can hear her voice. I can hear her personality. And I love that. And I respect that. And so for me, when I pick up a book, I kind of like, regardless of the genre or the topic, if I can't sense the person in the very first chapter, like, I don't want to continue to read that book. If there's not this element of some degree of vulnerability and connection I can have to them, because then it's not a story. It's just an idea, and it's just a marketed scheme. And so one book I want to throw out there just as a recommendation, because I have to say it on this podcast because it's one of my favorites that I recently read, is the book Rooted by Linda Lynn Haupt. I recommend anything she reads now. Like, I read it while we had COVID and I was up all night with Hudson, and I read it literally in like 12 hours, and it's become one of my favorite books that I think I'll carry with me for forever. But it starts with like a story. She talks about how she would, and the chapter is called Frog Church, and she like would, growing up, she had this little pond or whatever that she visited with all these little frogs, and she'd have frog church. And it was like, this story just like sucked me in, but it was like, I can relate to you. I can sense. And she talked about the difference between her frog church, where she got to be wild and barefoot and connect with living creatures that were amphibians, and how much there was like spirituality in that, versus her sitting in pews, having to wear shoes and being told that you can't do this, you can't do this, that this is not the way that you connect to God. And so I read that book, and I read that first few lines, that few first few pages. And it was just like, yes, like I feel you. I connect with you. And so that's kind of been a thing for me, is this person someone who's telling a story? Are they connecting to me, or are they just putting their ideas out there for the sake of money and branding? And it's usually pretty easy when you can change your brain to like connect that way.
I know for me, when I was writing and getting ready to publish God of the Gaps, I was working with an individual who wanted to only submit the manuscript to houses that publish predominantly for women. And I really pushed back on that and said, you know, like, this isn't a story, and this isn't a book. It isn't a perspective just for women. But it became really clear that because I was a woman writing, that it needed to be marketed predominantly to women with like a flowery pink cover and all of the things. And I decided to kind of go a different direction more on my own, because I didn't want that voice co-opted. And so I think that's an important point to make when you're looking at independence and things like that, because those voices are out there, but a lot of times they just don't fit inside the box and the funnel that's going to make the money.
Yeah. And I would just maybe add to that, not that a lot of people go to big box stores, you know, or bookstores to buy, you know, different Christian literature, but like most of the quote unquote Christian bookstores around, it's just almost all pretty toxic theology. Very rarely will they even carry something that doesn't just very much conform to, you know, very conservative evangelicalism. And so I just caution against even buying books in those stores. And, you know, there's some great imprints, like, for example, Orbis, for if you're interested in liberation theology. You know, if you see a book by Orbis, and then, you know, you can be pretty sure that it's going to be one that, you know, may not necessarily be a subject you're interested in, but you know it's written from the lens of liberation theology. And so paying attention to different imprints really matters. And you can learn a lot, you know, from that. So not to get into the weeds in that regard, but definitely, you know, there's some great imprints out there, but oh my gosh, you never find them in the Christian bookstores.
No, absolutely not. So I want to pivot for the last few minutes of this conversation to something that I know several of us on here also share a lot of fun passion around, and that is how it's important for us to not only to be deconstructing our bookshelves as adults, but it's also important to be deconstructing the bookshelves of the kiddos in our world and what that looks like to try to deconstruct, decolonize bookshelves for children. So Sherita, jump in here and talk a little bit. She's got her hand up. She's ready to go. Jump in here and talk a little bit about how critical and important the role that books play for kids.
I grew up as a reader, and books for me were a opportunity for me to explore the world that was not available to me. And, you know, in the current world of book banning and censorship, I think it's really important that children have the opportunity to read books that are outside of their world. And so one area that I did not grow up with that I have now discovered is science fiction. And I think science fiction books provide young people with the opportunity to dream and imagine in a way that is not taught. Oftentimes, we're taught to dream and imagine things that are real, things that are tangible. But with science fiction, it expands the mind beyond that. And so there are a few science fiction books that are really popular right now with young people that I think are important to consider. Children of the Blood and Bone. Mm-hmm. And it's African-American, African-centric with regards to science fiction. And I just think that this particular series has really connected. And there's been science fiction with African-Americans around for a long time. There are other science fiction authors that are out there for African-American. But this is a newer YA kind of series that I think is a way of connecting kids to a way of seeing themselves in a science fiction world, to seeing themselves in an otherworldly kind of experience. The other recommendation that I have is one of my former doctoral students. Her name is Lakeisha Johnson. She has a website. It's called Maya's Book Nook. And Maya's Book Nook is a website for children's book that promotes language and literacy skills through diverse children's literature. And she has hundreds of thousands of books that are linked to her website with resources and learning materials and book buying options and just a variety of things that are related to helping children to have diverse ideas and authors and concepts and language to join in. And it gives also some guidelines and things for parents to join with their kids in these conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, you know, one of my favorite things, my kids are quickly all approaching their 20s now. And so, but children's books have always been a huge thing of mine. So I've always found ways to continue to lean into that genre and purchase books and gift books. But I've really noticed over the last 20 years, something that I've noticed as a trend in children's books that I love and I celebrate is just how many more titles there are that are addressing feelings and mental mm-hmm. health and positive affirmations and positive body image. Susan Verde does a series, the I Am series, like I Am Courage, I Am Peace, I Am Love, I Am the One. Phenomenal series. I know I got Ellie one of those books on a trip recently and brought that home. And so like those titles that kind of help to build children up, especially in spaces where, you know, maybe those aren't messages that are always, you know, widely spoken into them, and how critical those are. Another thing that I experienced as a parent, I had two kiddos in my household that both had speech issues and had to do speech therapy. And there was a lot of issues with that. And I found my favorite children's book of all time, to this day, still my favorite children's book of all time. But it's called Hooray for Wadney Wat. And it is a book about a rat who cannot pronounce its R's. And it is phenomenal. And it is hilarious. And it makes me laugh out loud every time I read it. But that book was so important to my kids in that season, because it was like, oh, like there's a character that I can identify with. And so I think that that's really critical as well, getting those kind of titles on the shelves of kids in your world.
I think of one kid's book, well, two kids' books that have been really impactful for me as an adult reading them to two kiddos. And it's one that I think you're kid owns, Christy, and it's called The Night Before Pride.
Yes.
And I remember Lynn was reading it to me, and like tears started to form, because it's so reading stories like that and from like a kid's lens, where it's just so pure, it's so impactful. And I think, and also just seeing a lot more of like body affirmations, body positivity, a lot of like, you know, just like celebrating different bodies in kids' books has been really beautiful. There's a book that is published by a mom who had a kiddo with special needs and was quadriplegic, couldn't like communicate it differently. And it's all about, the book is all about how her son communicates differently and what different things mean, and like just this really humanizing aspect of like how not all language is important, even though those language, that language isn't words. And it's so, that was another one that I was like, how important having stories centered around kids with different abilities, with disabilities, and like how impactful that is too. Impactful for me as an adult. I can imagine like being a kid growing up with that narrative is so important.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say a couple of things. One of them about Rue. I love the cooperative youth group books that you kind of cultivated and curated. I think it's a great example out there for anyone who works with youth or works with children, you know, in whatever, you know, setting it might be, just to make sure that those books are available, you know. And I love that shelf so much, Rue, and appreciate the time that went into that. And just the other thing I want to briefly mention, I know we talk a lot about deconstruction and Christianity and such. If you're interested in that, there's a children's author named Matthew Paul Turner. And he comes out of deconstructing, similar to like a David Hayward and such. He even wrote a book with Rachel Held Evans, a children's book before her untimely passing. And so, you know, if you're looking for children's books from, you know, that talk about, you know, some things related to faith from somebody who's gone through deconstruction, you might check out Matthew Paul Turner's book with Rachel Held Evans.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great one. Another, thing I would say too regarding deconstruction in children, be really careful and mindful of even just like the children's Bibles that you're mm-hmm. purchasing and putting in your kids' libraries. You know, a lot of the illustrations and pictures that are oftentimes put and illustrated in those Bibles oftentimes are all white people, and that's highly problematic in so many ways. And so I think it's really critical that we're looking for not only diverse voices, diverse perspectives, but also accurate and diverse illustrations in books for kids, especially when it comes to like kind of those introductions to anything related to faith, theology, scripture, Bible.
I would be remiss if I did not mention UGMA Language and Literacy, which is my nonprofit organization. We have monthly family literacy nights on the second Wednesday of every month at 6 o'clock. It is an opportunity for families to come together with dinner and community and books. Every child leaves with a new book, and we have a very large collection of books that we've curated of diverse children's literature. We have books of different cultures, different religions, different family makeups, different abilities, for babies through fifth grade. And so we would love for anyone to join us who would like to be a part of a community that celebrates reading and celebrates diverse children's literature.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know for me, I think I didn't realize how much I needed kids' books in my life until I had kiddos. And I love their libraries. Like, cleaning up their books is one of my favorites, sitting down and reading with them. In fact, we go to Ujima every month, and Hudson knows the difference between our Ujima books and any other book. But I love just the diversity that's added to our. In fact, there was an event, and I love the fact that, like, I try not to have opinions when my kids pick out books, because it's like, I want them to make selections and know that, like, anything that they have an interest in is okay. And so there was a week that we went, and my daughter came home with a book in Spanish, and, like, we've read that book, and I've had to Google things, 'cause I'm like, I have a very minimal, I grew up learning Spanish as a child, but I did not retain a lot of that. But it's been really beautiful to, like, you know, for her, she loves that book, and it's about a rooster or something. And she loves getting to explore that language and being able to, like, say the words and this sense of empowerment in her of, like, I want to know a different culture, another language. So I think for me, one of the biggest things that I have had as I read books is that piece of it of, like, yes, my kids are white, where we currently live in Springfield, which has a very high percentage of people who are white. And, like, I may not always be able to, you know, have, like, I can't always control how much other cultures they get on a daily, but I can make sure that our books mm-hmm. are full of different cultures. And so making sure that we're adding books that have different skin, different culture, different spiritualities, mm-hmm. different language in them. And that's been probably one of the most creative ways that we've just introduced our kids to so much of that. And it amazes me how much they retain reading. My daughter's starting to read now, which has been really, I sent both Sharita and Christy a video this week of her reading. So it just, like, blew my brain, yeah. Getting to see how fast she's added things, but she's retaining as she's even reading mm-hmm. things. And it's really beautiful to hear her perspective on life. But a couple that I would just recommend, first of all, I think if you're local in the Springfield, Missouri area, visit Pagination Bookstore.
I was going to say the same.
Their kids, their books are incredible. It's very progressive. It's very multicultural for a small independent bookstore. But their kids section is amazing. And every book in that book section is related to connection to earth, connection to other cultures, other races, social justice, a lot of social emotional issues, a lot of accessibility and diversity. So that, like, we go in there and it's just like, I want to buy the entire bookstore. But a couple of the books I would recommend, I think I've said this, it's a TV show. It's also a book, then not quite Narwhal. It's got several different books in it, but some of those themes are really beautiful because while it's not, hey, this is a book on pride, it features this sweet little unicorn that has to come out to their narwhal parents that they're not a narwhal, that they're a unicorn. And it's the most beautiful theme that's interwoven into something that's not overtly, this is what this topic is about, but it teaches kids who are, you know, they may pick this up from the library and maybe they're growing up in a home where it's not affirming, and they're retaining some of that, of what that should feel like, what it should feel like to be yourself. There's a book called It Feels Good to Be Yourself. It's on pronouns and gender identities. I think you and Lynn bought it for my kids. And Ellie has, like, soaked that book up to the point, like, she went to preschool a couple of years ago and was asking all of her kids all of her friends what their pronouns are. And if they, you know, if they go by girl or boy pronouns, is how she was calling it in that season. But just, like, the exposure to that where it's so normalized mm-hmm. for her has been really beautiful. And another one that has been really has allowed us to have so many conversation is the book Hair Love, and just about different, you know, ethnicities and hairstyles. And it's been really interesting to talk to my daughter, especially about that, just, you know, how, cause it's a book about, you know, this sweet little girl that's owning her hair, and she's got ethnic hair, and it's big and it's hard to do sometimes and things like that. But it's about like the empowerment of a kiddo like that, being able to say like, I love my hair, and my daughter being able to say like, to connect to that, mm-hmm. even though that's not the hairstyle that she has and stuff like that. So I think those are pieces that I've been really, really proud of in the modern day culture of kids' books, is there's a lot of really beautiful, good things out there. And it's honestly not very hard to find. You just have to be willing to, you know, to explore a lot of the differences. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, I know our group, and we can talk about books all day long, especially kids' books. Any last thoughts from any of you guys as we start to kind of round the corner here?
I encourage parents to read books, and I encourage them to read books in the presence of their children. And I encourage them to read books with their children. It's important, not just for your literacy development, but for our personal development also.
And with that, remember, parents, if you have kids in your house, you're accountable for the titles that are on your bookshelf. And so the importance of deconstructing and decolonizing and making sure that any title that gets picked up is one that is going to share something that you would want shared, I think is also important, because I know that that was the case with a few books on my shelf once upon a time ago of like, ooh, I don't know that I necessarily want you reading that, thinking like that, processing that. So like, let's start in different spaces. And if we find our way to that, I think that's important too.
I think I would just say that it is important to go through your bookshelf and just take time to like really, you know, give yourself permission to go through titles that you no longer relate to and give them away or throw them away or whatever that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say that if you are in a space where maybe it has not been incredibly safe for you to be public with your deconstruction, or you're feeling really alone in that, books may be a really beautiful, because books can also be really private and really personal. And so that might be a really safe space for you to kind of find some friendship, is collecting some books that just give you the freedom to kind of explore what you believe and explore different ways of seeing the world. And then I would also just say that like books are, and you had said that like the resistance side of books. And so I think that there's something really powerful about connecting the books that you are purchasing to the things going on in the world. So like right now, purchasing books from authors that are Palestinian, like is a huge way of resistance. It's a huge way of supporting people that are experiencing intense amounts of struggle and harm. And so choosing specifically, like to me, like I sat down and I was literally exploring like who are some Palestinian poets, and it's opened my eyes to like so many beautiful poems and literature out there that I just hadn't been exposed to. But to be intentional about that, I know a few months ago, doing that with Ukraine, some Ukrainian authors, things like that. So finding ways to connect what you're reading with the things going on in the world is a really beautiful way to. Mm-hmm.
How about you, Phil? Any last thoughts?
Not a lot. I just really appreciate the intentionality that has gone into this conversation, each of the things that you all have shared. And, you know, when I think about, you know, books that I've picked up along the way, I just continue to go back to something Holly said several weeks ago about how deconstruction is celebration. As we're letting a lot of things go, it's because we're growing and we're learning about new things and engaging in new ways that just adds so much more to our lives. And so I just, you know, part of the deconstruction of the bookshelf means the chance to engage something new that helps take us to another place that's quite beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. When we remove something, we make space for something. And I think that that's important to always hold space for growth and having that growth mindset. And I think books give us the opportunity to cultivate a growth mindset in a way that few other things can. So I hope that this was a helpful episode. I hope that I appreciate this amazing group of humans, because this could have easily turned into, here's my 20 books to recommend to deconstruct your bookshelf. And I love that the conversation was less about what to read and more about how to engage in that process, because it's not about, you know, these are the titles that you must own to, you know, further your deconstruction, because everyone's deconstruction is individual and it's unique to you. And so it's less about conforming to a new checklist of books and titles and things. It's more about the process of what that looks like to evaluate, to let go, to seek out new things, and to challenge ourselves. So I hope you'll be able to apply some of this to your life. Share pictures and titles of books that maybe this encourages you to invest in our Facebook group. If you're not part of the Flip Table Community Facebook group, we invite you to join us. It's a great place where we can process information. We share questions and discussion questions and sometimes really great memes and all kinds of other things. So jump in there and join us if you haven't already. The link's on our website, and I'm sure we'll be sharing some book titles this week in that Facebook group. So we'll see you guys back next week.